Well, those of you that are visiting, my name is Dave. I'm one of the pastors here, and we are doing the main thing today, which is Jesus is the only way. We're in John chapter 14, verse 1 through 11, and there are no other options. Jesus is the only way. That is the main thing today. One of the most offensive things that Jesus ever said was in John 14, 6. The most offensive things. He stated that he was the only way to the Father, the only way to heaven, the only way to be saved. And this caused a lot of problems, particularly recently. It's led to criticism of the Christian faith, calling it intolerant and judgmental. It's led to questions like, what about all the other people of such and such a country we've never heard? What about devout Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists? What about all of them? It's offensive to claim that you're right and everyone else is wrong. I'm sure you've heard those things too. Well, we'll address each one of these and talk about what followers of Jesus do in response to all this. The first thing we have to recognize is that the objection to Jesus' claim is the only way has been subtly moved. It's subtly changed context. It's been subtle and sly. Notice that people don't say it isn't true. They say it's offensive. There's a big difference. What's the difference? Well, it's easy. One is an emotional argument, and one is a logical argument. All right? By moving the argument from whether the claim is true or false to the fact that it's offensive, critics are now appealing to feelings and not truth. Kind of like someone saying 2 plus 2 equals 4, and one person coming up and saying, well, it's offensive for you to say that 2 plus 2 equals 4. Well, it's not offensive. It's either true or false. In the same way, Jesus' statement that he's the only way isn't offensive. It's either true or false. All right? So either he is or he isn't. Either way, it's not offensive. It's either true or false. So here's a question. Is it true? Well, let's see what the expert on eternal life, Jesus, has to say about it. Jesus kind of does three things here, if you want to follow along here. Number one, Jesus believed that he was the only way because he said it. In John 14, 6, he said, I am the way and the truth and life. No one comes to the Father except through me. It's very apparent through the words of Jesus that he believed himself to be the only way. All right? He outright states it. Not a lot of gray area. And people say, well, we can't really trust the Bible. We don't really know if Jesus said that. Have you ever played the game Operator, where somebody tells somebody says something, and by the time it gets here, it's completely different than what said here. I've heard that. Well, John, the author, actually heard Jesus say this. This wasn't someone who heard someone who heard someone who heard someone. Jesus actually said it. We can be certain that Jesus said these words. So the second thing is that Jesus believed that he was the only way. His teaching showed it. In Matthew 28, 19 through 20, he tells us to go into all the world and make disciples. Why would he tell us to do that if there are other ways to him? Why would he do that? If there were another way to salvation, why would he told us to go into all the world and preach the gospel? Well, seriously, if people are okay the way they are, if Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists and atheists and the lot are all perfectly fine the way they are, why would he tell his disciples to go and make disciples all over the world? That makes no sense unless you believe that Jesus is the only way. And I've heard, as I'm sure as you have, that God won't judge someone who doesn't hear the gospel. You've heard that, right? That innocent guy in the middle of Sahara who've never heard the gospel, he won't go to hell when he dies. And that sounds great, except for that little innocent guy doesn't exist. The Bible tells us that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And that Romans 1 tells us that God's nature can clearly be seen, so we're without excuse. And think about it. If that statement that God won't judge someone who doesn't hear the gospel is true, then the cruelest thing that we can do as Christians is go preach the gospel. Because, think about it. If we go into all the world and tell people about Jesus and they reject him, they'll all go to hell. But if we stay put here and never tell anyone about him, everybody's fine. In fact, what we need to do is go over all the world and ask people, do you know Jesus? And if they say no, we need to tell them, good, here's what you need to do. If anyone ever comes up to you and mentions the name Jesus, you need to cover your ears and run away screaming, because as long as you don't hear the message, you're completely fine. But if you hear about him and you reject him, you're going to hell. Well, obviously Jesus didn't say that. By giving us the Great Commission, he told us to go reach a world that is lost and already going to hell. Already. It's like they're drowning in the water. And we've been told to save them with a lifeboat. They're not okay. It's what Jesus' teaching shows us. The third thing is that, and this is the most powerful one, that Jesus believed he was the only way. His actions showed it. In Luke chapter 23, 33, they came to the place called the Skull. They crucified him there, along with the criminals, one on his right, one on his left. If there was another way to heaven, believe me, Jesus would not have gone to the cross. If there was another way, if someone could get to heaven by being a good Hindu or being a good Muslim or being a good atheist, just being a good person, he would not have gone to the cross. He wouldn't have gone through it. But Jesus didn't say any of that. He knew that there's only one way, and therefore he went to the cross to satisfy the law of God so that God's wrath wouldn't be poured out on the people because of their sin. And the best illustration I've seen is this. Back when the westward movement was going on, one of the biggest dangers that the settlers in covered wagons faced were prairie fires. Some blown along by about 40 or 50 mile an hour gusting winds, prairie fires would devastate everything in its path. And so the wagon team leaders came up with a very, very amazing solution to save themselves from prairie fires. They couldn't outrun them. If they saw a prairie fire in the distance, they would go behind the wagons and they would set their own fire. And they would watch, they would burn up all the grain and everything like that. Then once all the grain was burned behind them, they would move the wagons onto the part that was already burned. And as the fire came through, the fire would go around them because there was no fuel, because the fire had already been there. They had to go to the place where the fire had already been in order to be safe. The same way. In order to be saved from God's wrath, we have to go to a place where the wrath of God was already placed, and that's Jesus. That's it. So knowing Jesus is the only way. He's the only way. According to Jesus, he is the only way. What is the believer to do? How do believers, what do followers of Jesus do? Knowing that Jesus is the only way. Well, in Daniel chapter 3, verse 4 through 29, there's a fantastic story. You guys probably heard the names, but you probably didn't know where it was. The names are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it's a great story. I want to invite you to turn there. There was an old gospel song several years ago, and probably most of you haven't heard it, but it was called They Wouldn't Bow, They Wouldn't Bend, and They Wouldn't Burn. And so listening to that song, it's like, well, that 3-point sermon right there. That's great. I'll just use that. They don't bow. That's the first thing that the followers of Jesus don't do. In light of this, they don't bow. In this story, it starts off with the words, King Nebuchadnezzar. Everybody say Nebuchadnezzar. It's more than just a ship in the Matrix. It's an actual guy. You know, the Babylonians conquered Judah, and they deported the people to Babylon. They went in, they carted them off hundreds of miles away from their home, and they enslaved them. Nebuchadnezzar was a brutal, egotistical man who believed himself to be God. And he set up an image of himself 90 feet high made out of gold, and he commanded people to worship him. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were teenagers who were serving in Babylon as captives. If you go to verse 4, Daniel 3, verse 4, the herald loudly proclaimed, nations and people of every language, this is what you're commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, pipe, and all types of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into the blazing furnace. All right. So this was a way for kings to enforce conformity among their conquered people, kind of like what Kim Jong-un is doing. I don't know if you knew this or not, but Kim Jong-un announced that because of what Trump is saying about war and everything, that millions of North Koreans have volunteered for the military. Yeah. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is giving everyone a chance to volunteer to worship him by putting up an image and putting a huge furnace blazing and billowing smoke in case you don't want to worship it. That's how totalitarian societies work. And everyone, when the conductor taps his baton and the musicians raise their, when they start playing, everybody hits the ground except the three. And some tattletales go to the king, and they say here in verse 12, but there are some Jews you've set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, O your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up. And this is no small deal. This is no small deal at all. Nebi had set up this huge image of himself, like he said, and right next to it, a huge furnace. And they could see the flames billowing out, and they could feel the heat. And the sole purpose of this was to burn people alive. They didn't do what he said. They were looking at this both at the same time. And let's say that Donald Trump sets up an image of himself and says, when you hear the music, I want you to fall down and worship it. I would imagine not one person in here would. That is, unless he also commands that those who don't will be burned alive in the huge furnace set up next to it. And people can see the image, they can see the furnace, they can hear the crackling of the wood, they can see the smoke billowing out. They can see it all. Not a hard choice for most people. Fall down and worship or be burned alive. Not a hard choice for most people. And when the conductor raises a baton, on the downbeat, you would have heard the sounds of tens of thousands of people hitting their knees, faces to the ground, except for the three. They're still standing. They're teenagers. I want to tell you, as a pastor, I pray for the teenagers in this church. I really do. I pray for the high schoolers and the middle schoolers. I pray they'll never bow down to the things of this world and have the courage to stand in full devotion to the living God like they did. See, the image was made of gold. It symbolized materialism. It was the default mechanism of the day. Materialism, gold, power. Second was an image of a man. It elevated humanity over God. The Bible tells us to worship God alone because he's the only way. And here was this image of a man that they were supposed to worship. Elevating man over God. That's the definition of humanism. And that is the default religion here in America. This official religion, and yet all over America, people are bowing down to it. And third, it falsified worship. You can threaten people all you want, but worship only comes from the heart. Worship can only be from the heart. And he understood, though, Nebuchadnezzar understood, there was a connection between worship and music. He understood that. See, God created music for us to engage and to enjoy and worship him with. That's why God created music. And many people report to me that they're here at Catalyst because of the music, how it moves them to worship God. But music is not innocent, you guys. It's not harmless. And who I want to ask you, who made the following statement? Let me write the music of a nation, and I will determine its morals. Was that Hillsong United? Maybe Madonna? Was it John Kelly and Catalyst worship team? Or was it Adolf Hitler? Answer is D, Adolf Hitler. Music will either draw you closer to God or draw you away from God. Nebuchadnezzar knew this. And I guarantee, if you're going through a tough time, your soul is weary, you're struggling, I want to ask you, unplug from everything else, unplug from all your secular music, unplug from Facebook, and unplug from the TV, and listen to nothing but praise and worship music for a week or 2 weeks, and tell me if your soul is not more inclined towards God. I guarantee it will be. Now, I'm glad that these three saw that God was the only way and there were no other options and they wouldn't bow to a false God like so many people in our country are. But then not only would they not bow, they wouldn't bend. Verse 13, furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you will not do what I say, that you won't serve my gods?" And that was nice of him. He was going to actually ask him, get the truth. He knew that the schemers were tattletales and were making stuff up. And he wanted to ask him. That was nice. And he says, when you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, all kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. Because I'm giving you another chance. Maybe you didn't hear the herald. Maybe you didn't hear the proclamation. Maybe you just were out of it or you were asleep. So I'm going to give you another chance. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? See, he thinks he's greater than God, doesn't he? He said, no God can stop you from what I'm going to do. I'm sovereign over God. Verse 16 and 17 are verses that all of you guys don't just need to underline. you need to memorize. You need to put it on your refrigerator, on your garage door, whatever. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. In other words, we've already made up our mind, King. You can give us a second chance. You can give us a third chance, a tenth chance, a thousandth chance. It doesn't matter. We've already made up our mind. And we will not. We aren't going to bow down and worship something that's false because Jesus is the only way. Verse 17, if we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. The God we serve is able. The God we serve is what? Able. I want you to say it again. God is able. God we serve is able. He's greater than you, King. You're nothing compared to him. As a matter of fact, the only reason you're still alive, King, is because the God we serve is enabling you to stay alive. But in verse 18, but even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. There's only one way, King. Verse 17 says, God is able to rescue us. We aren't bowing down. Verse 18, but even if he doesn't, if we don't get what we want, if he does not save us, we are not going to do what you want us to do, King. See, some of us have a faulty kind of faith. We have a foxhole faith. God, I will serve you, and if you will come through for me. Then there's real faith that says, even if I don't get what I want from you when I want it, I will still serve you. I won't bow, and I won't bend to anything else. See, there are people in here that are struggling today. I know it. There's maybe some people struggling with cancer. I believe God will save you from that. I believe that. I believe he's able. But if he doesn't, will you still serve him? I believe there are people in here that are struggling with addiction, and I believe that God will deliver you from that. I believe he's able. But if he doesn't, will you still serve him anyway? I know there are people in here struggling financially, and I believe that God will save you from that, that his ways are greater, and he's able. But even if he does not, will you continue to serve him? College students, there'll be a professor that'll make it clear that if you any talk of God, he'll fail you in the class. I believe God is more powerful than that, and I believe God will work in ways that you will pass. But even if he doesn't, will you still continue to take a stand for what you know is right? There are people here going through fiery, unimaginable trials, and I believe he will deliver you. But if he doesn't, will you still serve him? That's what real faith is. So many people don't get what they want when they want it, and they just quit. I'm a pastor. I know this better than anyone. People quit on God. They quit on church. They quit on their friends because they don't get what they want when they want it. And I'm just asking myself, where is your faith? Where is your trust in God? Where is it? You know, are you there only if you get what you want when you want it? Is that the extent of your faith? That's not faith. That's not even close to faith. Where's your faith? Where's your trust in God? Do you believe that God is able? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, God is able to deliver us. He's the only way. He's the only God. He's able. But even if he doesn't, if he chooses to turn us three amigos into the three taquitos, if he turns us into crispy bacon, we won't worship something false. We won't bow down to it. They don't bow. They don't bend. They don't burn. Verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's attitude towards him changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you get something 7 times. I mean, fire's hot, isn't it? I don't understand how you get it hotter, but he managed to do it. And then commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent, and the furnace so hot, the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. So how many of y'all are good at math? Got any math majors in here? Got people that can count? Good. Okay. Nobody. Not at all. Okay. Well, look at verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, weren't there 3? Shadrach, Meshach, three. Were there three people we threw in there? They replied, certainly, your majesty. He said, look, I see four walking around the fire. Who else did you throw in there? It better not be somebody that I liked. Who else did you throw in there? I count four. And the fourth one looks like the son of the gods, and none of them are hurt. They're unbound and unharmed. Who is this fourth man? Well, he's the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. That's who he is. Yeah, I can easily imagine Jesus up in heaven. He gets word from some of his angels that there are three men, three teenagers that are standing up in defiance to the most powerful man on earth. And he gets up from his throne. He steps across the ramparts of his heavenly castle. He gets on a starry staircase and he descends to our world. And he enters the blazing furnace and he's standing there waiting for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be thrown in. And he tells the flames, cool it. Because I'm sovereign here. I'm the only way. And I'm greater than Nebuchadnezzar. And I'm greater than the flames. And I'm greater than anything that you are facing right now. Cool it. And he looks at the three of them and says, no worries. I'm in control and I always have been. And I'm here in the fire with you. Verse 26, Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. Whoa, this is the guy that just a few verses ago said, what God will be able to save you from my hand? I'm greater than God. All of a sudden, whoa, he's like, servants of the Most High God. Come out here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw the fire not harm their bodies. Not a hair of their heads was singed. The robes were not scorched, no smell of fire on them. And Nebuchadnezzar said, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God, because they knew that Jesus is the only way. And whatever it is that you're going through right now, your son or daughter has left the faith maybe, or you've lost a spouse, or your marriage is teetering on the edge of collapse, or your business is tanking, you're about to lose your job. Whatever your trial is, you only have one goal. Only one goal in this trial, and it's not to be victorious. It is to keep trusting in God. Can I get an amen? Amen. That's your only job in the fire. It is not to be successful, not to be victorious. It is to keep trusting God. See, there are four lessons from the fire, and then you guys can write these down. Number one, persecution reveals your commitment. Whenever you face a trial, you really find out what you're committed to. The second thing, perseverance. And when you are learning perseverance, you're actually following in Jesus' footsteps. It says in the Bible that Jesus suffered, and therefore all people that suffered with that follow him will suffer as well. This is the one verse that's why I'm not a health and wealth prosperity gospel guy. When you suffer for righteousness, when you take a stand, when you stand up for what you believe, you are following Jesus' example. The third thing that we learn in the fire is presence. Jesus is never going to leave you. Where is the fourth man? He's right in the fire. When you go through a trial, Jesus is with you. Jesus never promises that you will not face trials. Don't hold him to a promise that he didn't make. He promises to stand with you while you walk through it. You learn his presence. And so many people say, oh, I don't like the trial. I don't like the challenge. Why does God have me going through this? God, why can't you just save me now? Why do I have to experience a trial? Why have you forsaken me, God? And the answer is the fourth one, purification. God uses the fire to purify you. Some of you are going through some tough times and trials. You're asking, God, why have you forsaken me? Where are you? Why aren't you answering my prayers? I want to tell you this from experience. That God is working in your life and in the lives of others in ways you cannot even imagine or fathom. God is refining you in that situation, and he's making you into the kind of person he wants you to be. Main thing is, there are no other options. Jesus is the only way. Jesus believed it. He believed it. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, followers of Jesus, this is what followers of Jesus do because they believe that he is the only way. Why don't you pray with me as the band comes on back up, and I want you to pray with me because I know there are people here that are going through the trial and going through the fire, and let's lift them up. Heavenly Father, in here today are people that are questioning.